atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Atherosclerotic. December 17th.
started doing this years and years ago when we slid from slides to actual PowerPoints.
Right.
We tried to tell these people when I was working for a big company, we tried to tell them that the computer needed 24 hours to remember it.
Is that right?
And they bought into it for about a week until they saw us fix it.
Right.
And they go, hey, wait a minute. I think you lied to me. Well, we just felt better. You know how it is when you get these guys to throw away the old one.
Right.
And there you are.
It's fairly big. I don't know if my... Is there such a thing? I'm so bad with tech. Is like, that's an old stick. Is there like newer technology in stick?
Well, they are a little bit faster, probably.
Right.
But they're huge now. You can get like 64 or 128 gigs. It'll hold your... Because that seems to be the future. Well, not really. All the Macs and all the new laptops are, you know, no more drives. It's all
right.
Dynamic drives. So everything gets a lot faster when it's not actually, it's faster to move things around. You don't hear anything spinning anymore.
Right. You're right. You're right.
Which is good, I guess. But it's just.
So sorry it's taking so long.
Oh, no. Gosh, it's easier with. You should see how long it takes when there's 150 people in the room.
Right.
Then it's like, forget it. They all do it. They go, here, you hold on to this critter.
Okay.
And then this is you. And let's just go up here. I call it a trophy. I don't know what it is. But then you got your clicker. And I don't know if you've got any kind of imaging. If you want, you know, so you got the laser pointer.
What are you pushing?
It's right there in the middle. There's no button.
It's
the first button you can get.
Okay.
And this one's kind of worn off, forward and reverse.
Okay.
And then if you've got imaging, if you drop this down one more.
I don't have any, so
it turns off that front bank of lights.
Okay.
So.
All right,
or
cool.
If you just want to hide in the dark,
hide.
That's a good one, too.
Right. Maybe that's what I want to do.
Like Dylan, a lot of people feel the podium's good because it's bulletproof. You know, you can hide up there.
It is. It's very tall, so you can really duck. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
you know, they share it with FAU, and it, for some reason, it got blocked. I got to call them back. It'll jump on top of you when they connect. There it is. Good, connect. We like that. Usually there's an image up above you. It's okay, I'll get my phone, they'll call and complain. If it happens, just ignore me, I'll come and push the button.
Oh, okay.
It's just that it'll disappear, because the way it works is whoever connects, and they're like the host, FAU is, they win the video presentation until you push a button and say, no, I actually am the boss.
Got it.
It just jumps on top of you. And it's all automated. There's no even kids there working their whatever in between class. Aren't they on? Didn't they do graduation or something? They did something the other day. So it's kind of an in between. It's kind of an empty campus right now.
Uh-huh.
But everything's all automated. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. We're going to get started with Grand Rounds. Thank you for attending. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce one of our own, Dr. Gregory Cohn, who's an internist practicing here in Boca Raton, who's got a specialty interest in cardiovascular preventative medicine and lipids. He went to medical school at the Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia and did his internal medicine residency at Thomas Jefferson University. And today his talk is going to be titled Implications of the Reducid for Management of Residual Risk in Atherosclerotic Cardiovascular Disease.
Good morning, everybody. Everybody hear me okay? So I was just double checking with John. I believe this is our last Grand Rounds for the year. Next Tuesday is the day before Christmas. And then after that's New Year's. And so I'll try to send it out with a bang. I'm actually, again, thanks, John, for the intro. I'm very excited to talk to you today because I have some information which is very current and literally some stuff hot off the presses. And I think will be very valuable for patient care. So I appreciate you all coming. So I have no disclosures. Now, I've tended to get away from this the last couple times, but you're stuck with me today, so I got to give you a little history. I'm sorry. So you might know, those of you who have any interest in history, might know this is a famous painting of the British surrender to the Americans and the French at Yorktown. So why did I pick that for today? That was October, mid-October, 1781. Mostly because I'm working my way through Ron Chernow's biography of George Washington. And when I tell you work my way through, it's about 900 pages. So it is truly something that will take time. If he's the author of Hamilton, which was the what's the word I'm looking for? What the show Hamilton grew out of, and he's a wonderful, wonderful author. If anybody has interest, I'd highly recommend his biographies of Hamilton, Grant, or Washington. But in any event, that was one of the reasons. So the basic story here, you probably remember, is Cornwallis, the British general, moved his army to Yorktown, which is at the end of a peninsula. And by fortuitous events, a fleet of French ships from the Indies came over and in a battle with the British fleet, beat the British fleet and chased them back to New York. And so the French fleet controlled the water right outside of Yorktown. And then a combined American and French army sealed off the land. And so Cornwallis was trapped. And it was just a matter of time. They laid siege until the British surrendered. So sort of the story within the story, which is, I think, kind of neat, is at the day of the surrender, the British commander Cornwallis claimed that he was ill and couldn't attend to actually be the one to surrender, so he sent his second-in-command. And the second-in-command, when he went to present the sword, tried to surrender to the French general. And the French shook their heads no and pointed them to the Americans. And so the general went over to George Washington, and Washington shook his head no and pointed to his second in command, whose name is Benjamin Lincoln. And the reason he did that is because about a year earlier, Benjamin Lincoln had to surrender the city of Charleston, South Carolina, and was humiliated by the British during that surrender. The etiquette of the day was that when you surrendered, you were honored and the troops could march out with their flags flying. Well, the British denied General Lincoln that honor, And so Washington had the second-in-command surrender to Lincoln. And to make up for being humiliated in Charleston, they did not let the British fly their flags either. And tradition has it that the British band played a song called "The World's Turned Upside Down" as the troops marched out and laid their guns down. So that's sort of the inside story, kind of neat. And there is another reason why I picked this, and it's because it dovetails very well with my message today. One of the big things I wanted to talk about today is the topic of what's called residual risk, which we'll look at in just a second. Residual risk. This is an old slide, but you don't even really need to look at it so much. We've been very successful with the use of statins, and unprecedented, as a matter of fact, in terms of cardiovascular disease reduction, event reduction. But the fact of the matter is that the majority of patients who take statins still have events. And that's what we call residual risk. Why is it that patients that take statins still have still go on to have cardiovascular events? And again, these are some of the older trials, but even a trial like 4S, which was a very early trial, very high-risk population, you can see still 60% of people continue to have events despite statin treatment. And they're all, again, secondary trials, primary prevention. So any way you look at it, a large number of patients taking statins still have events. So the point is that in order to maximally reduce risk, we need combinations. We need more than one thing. And getting back to the history, the Americans didn't defeat the British by themselves. They wouldn't have been able to win the war without the help of the French, particularly the French fleet. So again, it's in combinations that we will maximally reduce risk. So what evidence do we have for medications that are already out there that reduce residual risk? So basically, we have evidence for two. The one medication is ezetimibe, or Zetia, has further reduced cardiovascular events in the IMPROVE-IT study. And we have two available PCSK9 inhibitors, which, again, like Zetia, when given on top of statin therapy, have been shown to reduce cardiovascular events. It appears that certainly for Zetia, but the PCSK9 inhibitors as well, their main effect is on further reducing LDL. Little effect on other particles, some, but that still remains to be seen as whether that's what's important. But the bottom line is, one aspect of residual risk is further lowering LDL. But what else could there be? So the last talk I gave was about triglycerides and how triglycerides representing triglyceride-rich lipoproteins were indeed a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. But do we have proof? And that's a question. So the main medicines that are available to lower triglycerides are three. We have fibrates, of which the main one in clinical use is fenofibrate. We have niacin, and we have omega-3 fatty acids, or fish oil for short. So in the modern era, using statins, what's the proof? So we have this trial, the ACCORD trial, which used fenofibrate on top of simvastatin in diabetics. And we have two studies with extended-release niacin, which was, again, on top of statin therapy, very low LDLs in what was called the AIM-HI trial and the heart protection study, number two. Both of those, all three of those trials actually didn't meet their primary endpoints. So the answer is no. But you see, I have a little asterisk there. And that's because when you look a little closer at the data, there's some hints about what may be going on. So this is a subgroup analysis from the ACCORD trial. Again, these were diabetic patients on simvastatin, some of whom got fenofibrate, the others got placebo. And what you'll see here is this group on the left, the so-called dyslipidemic group, had triglycerides at least 204 and HDL cholesterol low levels less than or equal to 34. And you can see about a 31% reduction that just missed statistical significance in that subgroup. And if you look at the corresponding group that did not have that, there was absolutely no benefit. So that sort of hints that this group may be the one to target. So some authors went back and actually looked at other fibrate studies. And that includes the field study, the BIP, which uses the medication benzofibrate, which is not available in the U.S., the Helsinki Heart Study, which is an old study, and the VA HIT study. All these use different fibrates. And again, they looked at the dyslipidemic group. It wasn't exactly the same, but they got as close as they could to that ACCORD subgroup. Basically, elevated triglycerides over 200, HDL cholesterol levels lower, on the lower side. And again, you can see that all the fibrate trials show a benefit in that subgroup, whereas the group without the dyslipidemia didn't have a benefit. So you say, duh. I mean, you designed the trial with a medicine to lower triglycerides. Wouldn't it make sense that the group with the high triglycerides would be the one that benefits? Yes, but the people that designed these studies didn't limit the patient population or choose in the right way. So what about fish oil or omega-3 fatty acids? So I'm sure you're all aware, there was a time when it seemed to me like every other month there was a study being published about the fish oil, about the fatty acids. One was positive, but most were negative. This is a summary from a meta-analysis from last year. I'm not going to show you all the different trials. But again, you can see here, these are all major cardiovascular events, and to the left favors treatments, to the right favors control, and everything is pretty much right down the middle for the fish oil. There was this one little bit, though. CHD, coronary heart disease death events, that just met statistical significance. So again, some hints. So where did that leave us? What about this trial? This is a very interesting trial called the JELIS trial. This was from 2007, and this took place in Japan. It was a mixture of primary and secondary prevention, meaning some patients who did not have known cardiovascular disease, some patients that did. And all the patients received statins, although in Japan, they use low doses as opposed to here. That may have changed more recently, but again, we're talking this trial in 2007. So doses of pravastatin and simvastatin of like 5 and 10 milligrams, so what we would consider to be very low. And it was an open label study that in addition to the statin, patients got this isolate of EPA, very pure EPA, which is one of the two main components of fish oil, DHA and EPA. So this is pure EPA in the amount of 1,800 milligrams a day, given as a 600 milligram tablet three times daily. So on the left here is the total cohort. Again, remember, primary and secondary prevention, so a mix of higher risk and lower risk. And what you see is there was a statistically significant reduction in events in the entire population, the dark line being the EPA and the lighter line being the control. And then they did a subgroup analysis. Again, doesn't quite match the exact criteria of the other studies, but triglycerides of at least 150 and HDL below 40, and look at the difference in those patients. An over 50% reduction in events. So, I know I'm showing my age here. Does anybody here remember this game? What a great game. You built this trap, and you the marble would go through the tub and down the thing and all over the place and ultimately would come to a cage that would wiggle down and trap your mouse. So finally, some smart people got together and said, how do we build a better mouse trap? In other words, how do we make a better study? And that leads us to the main topic for today, and that's the Reduce-It trial, which goes by the title of Cardiovascular Risk Reduction with Icosapent-Ethyl for Hypertriglyceridemia. This was, This was published in the New England Journal early this year. So again, it goes by Reduce-It, much easier to say that. Icosapent-Ethyl is EPA, a pure EPA form. And this was a very, I think, well-done study, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled. The dose of EPA, 2 grams twice daily, 4,000 milligrams of EPA. They split their population again, similar to Jealous, into secondary and primary prevention, but they limited primary prevention to up to 30% of the trial. And here were the criteria. If you had disease, you had to be at least 45 years old or 50 years old in the primary prevention part of the study, with diabetes and one additional risk factor. They did make criteria for fasting triglycerides of a minimum of 150, and the LDL cholesterol had to be controlled between 41 and 100 on a stable dose of statin. And as we'll see, these patients were very well controlled. So because triglycerides can vary somewhat, they were accepting in the beginning a 10% variation, which meant that some people could have triglycerides as low as 135. So I think they saw that and, again, went back to the data and saw that the main benefits were in patients with higher triglycerides, and so they subsequently raised the lower level of triglycerides to 200. You can read the primary endpoints and secondary endpoints, major things that we would all want to prevent. And there was about 8,200 patients. Again, about 71% were secondary prevention, 29% primary prevention. And the median follow-up was almost 5 years. So I know a very busy slide, and I don't want you to look at all of it. This is just showing you the breakdown between the two groups. But there is something I want you to focus on for a minute, and that's within the red box here. So what you'll see here is that the median triglyceride level was 216 between the two groups. So again, that would fit that high-risk dyslipidemic group we showed from before. Median LDL cholesterol was about 75. So these are well-controlled patients. And here is the distribution of triglyceride levels. So again, there was about 10% of patients who were below the 150 mark, about 30% that were borderline, which is above 150 and below 200, but the majority, about 60%, were above 200. And then right down here at the bottom is the dyslipidemic group that I had showed you from the ACCORD trial. Triglycerides greater than 200 and HDL cholesterol less than 35. And again, you can see about 20% of the patients fit that criteria. So this slide shows you the effects of the IPE, icosapent-ethyl, on these various biomarkers. So you can see that there was statistically significant reductions here, or statistically significant differences amongst all these different biomarkers. Again, we'll draw attention to some. So triglycerides in the IPE group dropped very nicely. In the placebo group, by the way, the placebo group got mineral oil, and we'll come back to that. So you can see the triglycerides really didn't change in the placebo group. Non-HDL cholesterol, which if you remember, is probably the better measurement to use when triglycerides are elevated in terms of quote-unquote bad cholesterol. A very mild reduction on the IPE group and an increase in the placebo group. LDL went up a tiny bit in the IPE group, went up a little bit more in the placebo group. ApoB, which again is a measurement of all atherogenic particles, so it's sort of the particle equivalent of non-HDL. Anything that's potentially atherogenic will have an ApoB protein on it. So you can see a very slight reduction in the ApoB and a slight increase in the placebo group. And then lastly, which I think is important, we'll come back to, hsCRP, marker of inflammation. Again, very sensitive but non-specific marker of inflammation. So you can see a reduction in inflammation levels in the IPE group, whereas an increase in the placebo group. So how did this bear out for the primary events and secondary events? So again, I'll show you the graph in a second, the curves. But for primary, there was a 25% reduction, very statistically significant, 25%. That's very, very significant, very big. Secondary endpoint, 26%. And then there were a variety of tertiary endpoints, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I did want to highlight this one, which is adjudicated sudden cardiac death. There was about a 30% reduction in the IPE or fish oil group, and that sort of bears out some earlier findings. So here's the curve of the primary endpoint, and just highlights what I just said. And I think it's important to note that you can see the lines start to separate at about a year or so. So it wasn't an instantaneous benefit, but it took about a year for them to separate. And here's the secondary endpoint, and took a little longer here, somewhere a year and a half, a year and two-thirds, a year and three-quarters, something like that, before they started to separate. But again, wide divergence, significant reductions. And then here is a breakdown of those endpoints sort of broken down into individual things. And again, you don't have to read them all. The gist is, if you look over here, every single one of these met statistical significance except for total mortality. And when you look at total mortality, there was indeed a reduction, but it just didn't meet statistical significance. So I think very impressive results. Again, remembering, in a patient population with an LDL cholesterol median of 75 on statin therapy. So this is really interesting. What about in our pre-specified subgroups? Again, very busy, lots of stuff. Look at the big picture. Again, you can see most to the left of the line favoring IPE. I'm going to draw your attention, again, within the red box. So here are the patients with baseline triglycerides greater than 200 or less than 200. You can see both groups benefited, and there was no real difference between them, statistically speaking. Here's baseline triglycerides of 150 or less than 150. The less than 150 didn't quite benefit statistically, but there was no real difference. But if we go to our dyslipidemic group, again, those with both high triglycerides and low HDL cholesterol, you'll see that those that had it had a very big reduction, while those that didn't still had a reduction, but this was statistically significant. So again, doesn't seem to matter where the baseline triglycerides were, but if you had a combination of high triglycerides and low HDL cholesterol, you seem to get a bigger bang for your buck here. This is a secondary endpoint, and the red box highlighting the same groups. There was no statistically significant difference among the dyslipidemic groups here. So it does not appear that attainment of triglycerides less than 150 at 1 year influenced whether you had an event or not. But as I said, in the dyslipidemic group, there was a greater reduction in events that met statistical significance compared to a group that did not have as severe dyslipidemia. And what about safety and adverse events? So interesting, AFib was a bit higher in the IPE group. You can see both the incidence of AFib and rate of hospitalization for it were both statistically higher. The other thing that people worry about with fish oil is the effect on bleeding. And you can see that there was more bleeding events in the IPE group than in the placebo, was not statistically significant, and that no fatal bleeding events in either group. And fortunately, no significant differences in the rate of serious bleeding, hemorrhagic strokes, GI bleeding, et cetera. So what do we conclude from this study? 20% lower risk of cardiovascular death in statin-treated patients with a baseline LDL of 75. I know I've said this now three times. This is really big. This is not what you would expect. Remember, the LDL cholesterol hardly changed here. Yet we still got a very big reduction in events. There were more bleeding events with the IPE, but again, the rates were low overall, and more atrial fibrillation diagnoses. But I think in the big picture, relatively less versus a bigger benefit. That's something that's going to need to be looked at more in the future, I think. Again, the benefits were the same or similar across the baseline triglyceride levels, whether they were low, borderline, or high. And the benefits accrued no matter what triglyceride level was attained at the end of the first year. Now, what were some of the criticisms? And when I say criticisms, I'm putting that in quotation marks. So what could possibly explain some of this? Well, some authors looked at those LDL levels, which I showed you. And the fact that, if you remember, the LDL cholesterol levels in the IP group went down a little bit, whereas in the placebo, it went up about 7 points. So that there was somewhat of a difference in the LDL cholesterol levels between the two groups. Could that explain why the IP group looked like it did so much better? Well, they did a post hoc analysis just on the placebo patients to see if their LDL cholesterol level stayed the same or went up. Was there a difference? And they found none. And then the other potential explanation, or at least partial explanation, had to do with the inflammation levels, which I made a point to show you. So again, the mineral oil placebo actually raised the hsCRP level by a significant amount, and the IPE group lowered it, again, augmenting a difference between the two. So that is potentially a reason, but I think that if you take into account both of these, LDL and the inflammation, it's still not enough to explain a 25 to 26% reduction with IPE. So I want to take a look a little closer and see if we can tease out, not definitively, but some possible explanations for why EPA may have cardiovascular benefits. And again, it appears to be more than simply lowering triglycerides as well. So this was another study based on REDUCE-IT, published in JACC, where they looked at all the ischemic events, and you'll see what I mean in a second. So they looked at whether the events were the patient's first event, if they were the second, third, or fourth. Was there a difference in reduction? And again, you can see here, this is the placebo group on the left, the IPE group on the right, and whether it was a first event, second event, third event, or fourth event, all were lower in the IPE group, so that there was in total less 470 less cases of ischemic events overall for 30% reduction. And then this was just published online in circulation, but was presented at the AHA meeting last month. This is called Reduce It USA. So the Reduce It trial was an international trial. This is just the patients from America. So if you gave the patients, 1,000 patients in America, and gave them the IPE and the dose that the trial did, these would be the number of events and deaths that you would prevent in 5 years. Again, very, very impressive. So one way of trying to look at this is to try to put this trial, Reduce It, in perspective with the other triglyceride-lowering trials that we at least alluded to in the beginning. So this is another, I think, really important article, came from Circulation this year, where they did just that. So it was a meta-regression analysis, and they looked back at the magnitude of reduction of non-HDL cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, triglycerides, and the relation to reduction in major cardiovascular events. And these were, again, in the triglyceride-lowering medications, fibrates, niacin, and omega-3 fatty acids. And they also looked at statins as well as an established reference. And then additionally, in the omega-3 trials, they separated the dosing of DHA and EPA to look at those two separately to see if, again, we could tease out some different effects. So the details are 24 triglyceride-lowering trials, very large number of patients, baseline triglycerides 163, average follow-up 5 years, lots of events, and again, 25 statin trials, same thing. So what did we find? So again, a little bit hard to read, but I'll walk you through it. So we have two different graphs here. This top graph along this line is the difference in triglycerides. And this is relative risk on the y-axis. So the solid regression line, this is including all of these trials of statins, fibrates, niacin, and fish oil. That's what this solid line is. So you can see there's no question as triglycerides increase or as the difference in triglycerides increases, there is a reduction. Now, what's that dashed line? The dashed regression line is if you remove the Reduce It trial and look at all the rest of the trials. And what do you see? A significant attenuation of that effect. So the Reduce It trial has a very, very powerful influence over this group of results. Down on the bottom, this is for LDL cholesterol with the same y-axis. Again, all the trials. And again, you see a steeper decline for reduction in LDL. And the regression line minus the Reduce It trial, there's hardly any difference. And you might expect that because Reduce It, IPE, really didn't affect LDL cholesterol very much. So what about the fish oil trials? So there were 13 of them, and 11 of them used a combination of EPA and DHA. This is what, you know, the trials have used overall. The only two that didn't were the two I showed you. The one was the Jealous from Japan. The other was Reduce It. And you can also see from this part of the reason why I think the results from all of the studies are so mixed. Because look at the different dosing, the dose range of total omega-3 dose. It's ranged from a low of less than 400 milligrams out to 4,000 milligrams. So you can imagine that you might see differing effects from a low dose versus a high dose. And I think that does go a long way in explaining why some trials are positive, some are negative. Here's the breakdown in the individual EPA dose. Again, the 4,000 milligram dose comes from the Reduce It, and DHA dose up almost a gram a day. Pardon me. So here we have our regression lines again. I apologize, it's a little blurry. Oop, keep doing that. So this top graph is for the dose of EPA. This is increasing dose. This is relative risk. And look at how steep that line is. Again, here's Reduce It down here.
Here's jealous over here. And the bottom graph is for DHA. And you can see it's almost flat. It's not significant at all. So it looks like there's something special, perhaps, about EPA. So what were the conclusions from this meta-analysis? So basically, triglyceride lowering is associated with a lower risk of major cardiovascular events, but to a lesser extent per absolute unit of reduction than LDL. I don't think that's any big conclusion that we didn't know, but again, you saw from the lines, the slope of the lines. But it also, I think, highlighted the fact that nearly all the non-statin trials have been underpowered with respect to lowering of non-HDL to really prove a benefit. Again, REDUCE-IT was the most significant outlier and influencer of the meta-regression, and removing it attenuated the effect estimate for the triglyceride lowering, which I showed you with those lines. So why would it have been an outlier? Well, was it the medication itself? Was it the dose? Or was it the placebo? Was it the fact that the placebo raised the inflammation level where, again, the IPE reduced it? So what are potentially some of the other benefits or reasons why IPE or omega-3 fatty acids might have a cardiovascular benefit? So I would say to you that there is data supporting all of these mechanisms. When I say that, it doesn't mean clinical trial evidence, but certainly scientific evidence in the lab for some of these things. And I think it's clear that there is some effect on bleeding and definite anti-inflammatory effects. I mentioned, I teased out that sudden death endpoint for you because there is some evidence from earlier trials that sudden cardiac death is lower in ischemic patients taking fish oil. And these are some of the other potential benefits. And interestingly, which I'm going to show you in just a second, there's some evidence that it might actually affect the growth of the growth or stability of atherosclerotic plaque. So that brings us to this study, called the Evaporate study. And this was just a small study, but it was randomized and double blind. And this study used CT. This was with CTA to look at characteristics of plaque and how it changed with patients on statin plus placebo, statin plus IPE. You can see that triglyceride levels were roughly the bottom, the same bottom as in Reduce It, but limited to up to 500. LDLs in a generally good range, again, on statins. So this were these were the main endpoints. They were looking primarily at low attenuation plaque volume on the CTA. Low attenuation plaque is a marker of high-risk plaque, plaque that is likely to rupture and cause events. But there were other secondary endpoints. They also looked at change in markers of inflammation, changes in lipids. And this is the results that were released at the AHA meeting last month. This is just at 9 months. The study is scheduled to go on for 18 months total. So this is, again, the main primary endpoint, this top selection here, low attenuation plaque. You'll see the IPE group is in the blue, the placebo's in the orange. So there was a difference. There was a reduction in low attenuation plaque with the IPE, but it did not meet statistical significance. Some of these other types of plaque, fibrofatty plaque, actually seemed to be an increase in the IPE group, but the difference here was not significant as well. But if you look at the rest, fibrous plaque, calcification, total non-calcified plaque, and total plaque, all were in favor of the IPE group. So looked at another way, these were the percentage reductions. And again, except for the primary endpoint of the low attenuation plaque and the fibrofatty plaque, everything else was significant. So perhaps this is one of the reasons why we saw such good results in REDUCE IT. Again, this study will be continued and go out to 18 months. Obviously, the results will be released at that time. So based on all this, a lot of the major health organizations have come out in favor of the use of IPE in addition to statins. You can see AHA, ADA and their standards of care, the European Atherosclerosis Society and European Society of Cardiology, and the NLA. And then, you know, I looked at my email this morning, and I know you're not going to see this, but in one of my alerts, the FDA approves use of drug to reduce risk of cardiovascular events in certain adult patient groups. So the FDA yesterday approved the use of VASC-EPA, which is the IPE from the REDUCE-IT study, in patients with triglyceride levels over 150 for secondary prevention of events. So, and then just for your information, if you're interested, this is a science advisory from the AHA really summarizing pretty much state of the art, all the data about the different omega-3 fatty acid trials, including REDUCE IT. And I highly recommend that to any of you that are interested and want to read more and get some details on it. Okay. So that's pretty much my talk. I have two more slides left, which I can show you if you're interested. I'll explain what they are. If not, I'll be happy to take questions. The two slides, just so you know, and then I'll take the questions. They're about the effects of DHA versus EPA on LDL cholesterol, which is something that may be important to some folks. So I'm happy to take some questions, if any. Right.
The line separation, and a casual observer will not notice that. These are not, and they're not linear numbers. So, and when you talk about relative risk reduction from 0.9 to 0.89, one really begs the question on the number needed to treat, okay, the NNT, from a practitioner standpoint, really is the valid number. If you really need to treat 1,000 patients, and let's say you see 1,000 patients a month or a year, then you're going to impact that patient once. There's no question. I'm not arguing the impactfulness of these, you know, mega studies and this mega meta analyses, but I think the tempering message from all of these kind of presentations should be a kind of gut check or reality check for the audience at the kind of foot soldier level.
I don't disagree with what you're saying. I'm just going back just for one bit here. I'm sorry, just give me a second, and I'll... Okay, let's go to the first one. So here's the number needed to treat for the primary endpoint in this study of 21 patients. That's pretty darn good. And the secondary endpoint, 28 patients. So I think just at least from the REDUCE-IT standpoint, very, very impressive results. I agree to when you start using logarithmic, you make it look like a much bigger thing lots of times than what it truly is. And in fact, the actual risk reduction may be smaller, not a relative risk reduction. I think that's well worth remembering. But in this particular case, at least for this REDUCE-IT study, I think the results are very, very impressive. Okay. So if you'll bear with me for 1 second, I'll just go through to the end. It'll just take me 1 second to show you the slides. Almost there. Okay. Okay. So, a certain drug company that will go unnamed, when they come to your office to tell you why you should be prescribing IPE, one of their claims is, we don't raise LDL cholesterol. And therefore, LDL cholesterol is bad, and so therefore, you should use our product and not another omega-3 fatty acid product. So I just wanted to take a look at that for a second. So this is from that AHA statement, which I showed you a couple slides ago, sort of the summary of everything. And here's the statement. In conclusion, there's no strong evidence that DHA containing prescription N3 fatty acids, omega-3 fatty acid agents used as monotherapy or in combination with statins raise LDL cholesterol in patients with hypertriglyceridemia. So, again, I think you have to realize that when there is sort of an inverse relationship here, when triglycerides are high, particularly when they're elevated, LDL cholesterol levels are low. And then when you lower triglycerides, you can see some rise in LDL cholesterol, but this is occurring from conversion, again, of fatty particles into LDL, but also enlargement of LDL particles that have been very small to larger ones. So that's part of it. And if you look at the bigger picture, which again is the non-HDL cholesterol measurements or the ApoB measurements, they go down. So it's sort of a figment of measurement, if you will. Typically, if the LDL cholesterol does go up, it's a very small amount. But occasionally, in someone with very, very high triglycerides, you could see up to 30%. I've never seen that before. And the other thing I think that's really important is we're not talking about use of the omega-3 fatty acids here in isolation. We're talking about using them in combination with statin drugs. So your statin is going to help to lower the LDL. So in other words, what I'm basically telling you is I don't think that's a valid reason for telling you not to use a DHA-containing agent. If you're going to use IPE, use it because of the results of the trial, not because it doesn't raise LDL cholesterol. So I have not had anybody turned down for this yet who met the criteria. In other words, they were someone who had triglycerides that were elevated above 150, that either had heart disease or were diabetic with another risk factor and were on a statin drug. So if you meet those criteria, the drug companies have been paying and hasn't cost my patients anyway a huge out-of-pocket expense. Sean?
So five grades are out, pretty much.
So that's a great question. So I would tell you that personally, I have gotten away from fibrates over the years and have used, this is not necessarily backed by science here. This is my personal. So I tend to use a lot of fish oil, and I use metformin actually a lot as well. And part of the reason is, again, fenofibrate is generally a well-tolerated medicine. You can combine it with statins safely, generally not an issue, but there are some effects on the creatinine. You worry about gallstones. And so I tend to think of fish oil as sort of a no-brainer. It's natural. It has multiple benefits. And really, what's the side effect? Some people complain about, you know, burping a fishy taste. You can generally get around that. So that's sort of been my personal thing. Now, if you go by that meta-regression analysis, it would basically tell you that most of those fibrate trials were underpowered. In other words, they didn't select enough patients or enough of the right patients to really show the benefit. So I think if you were going to use fibrates, you should try to limit it to that dyslipidemic group, the ones that have a combination of triglycerides over 200, HDL cholesterol is less than 35. Sean? Yeah. None that I'm aware of. Right. Agreed. Niacin potentially as well. Fish oil doesn't seem to do that. The bleeding, you know, the bleeding is always a mystery to me. I just don't think there's enough data about it. There's data that says fish oil affects the bleeding time. But clinically, I don't really know what that means. And I'm sure anybody here who does pre-ops, you know, for patients, it's a standard thing. If you're taking fish oil, you know, we're supposed to stop it, you know, a week or whatever ahead of time. I just don't really know where the data is that says the fish oil increases the bleeding risk other than like, what certain, you know, anecdotal and things like that. Even I remember the first prescription fish oil, Lovaza, if you looked at their package insert about using it with patients on Coumadin, they said basically they had be cautious using over 3 grams in patients on Coumadin. But it wasn't like they were basing it on, you know, like a mountain of data or anything. It was just sort of something that was thrown in there. So. Right. Dr. Lee, do you have any comment about that? Do you see like an increasing bleeding, you know, for your procedures or anything?
No, not at all. I mean, I don't keep track of what proportion of patients are fish oil. Mm-hmm. Unless they're based on our side of the discipline, there's no mention of that at all.
Hmm.
I do want to ask you
a question. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so.
And what about in terms of glycemic control
for people who are not diabetic? Okay, so first off, believe it or not, when metformin was first discovered as a medicine that lowered triglycerides. Okay? Okay, so again, I can't sit here and give you a statistic, but I will just say that the vast majority of patients with elevated triglycerides are insulin resistant. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that they have a sugar problem necessarily, but they are insulin resistant. So I'm not saying that I would use metformin all the time, but if I have sort of a metabolic syndrome patient who has either impaired fasting glucose or an A1C, you know, in the pre-diabetic range, and they have triglyceride problems, and they're overweight, I think metformin is a great choice. And you do have some proof from studies about use of metformin in pre-diabetics to prevent diabetes. So whenever again, my opinion, when you can use a medicine that has effects on multiple different problems to improve it, and you won't cause hypoglycemia. Metformin does not cause hypoglycemia, which is another thing that you don't have to worry about. Great. So I thank you very much for your attention.
I'll be right there. Just hang up on FAU.
Thanks, Gary.
Yep. And
I'm just going to set it up. Right
here. Yep, you can have it. And
CIAs along with angina, very similar. So it's a, I always feel like cardiac and neuro are always very close together because when it talks about cerebral vascular, it's just like cardiovascular. So there's a lot of things similar, but there's going to be a lot of things different. The other thing is when we go through it, I don't want you to feel overwhelmed, especially when I start out with a little bit of the neuroanatomy. I'm making it very specific to symptoms that you may see that are stroke-like symptoms. I think that most people, again, are very aware. You get this big facial droop, a loss of movement. That's a stroke, right? But there's a lot of little changes, little subtle things that could also be a stroke that people miss. And that's the area that we don't want to miss as a group that's working with TIAs. So it's an area that I really try to emphasize some of the other things that you're going to see and why. You know, I'm always a big person on why. The other thing that makes this TIA a little bit harder, because everyone's going to go, hey, we're here for TIAs, not with strokes. But the thing is when you have somebody that's a TIA, right, they have symptoms that are resolved, but they had symptoms. We don't know if that person has actually had a stroke or not until typically we do a follow-up MRI, right? Because that first CT scan, when we say it's negative, it only means what? There's no bleed. Exactly. So when we say negative, it just means there's no bleed. It doesn't mean the patient didn't have a stroke, right? So we now are going to call this a TIA, and then we get an MRI 8 to 24 hours later, and there's this stroke, all right? So that patient that you're taking care of that is called a TIA may actually be a stroke. And I think that's the hardest thing in the neuro versus in cardiac. You have your EKG changes, you have the elevated troponins, you know, you've got markers. We don't have markers in a stroke, all right? So we don't have any of the enzymes that you can draw, hopefully in the future, but not as of right now, all right? So it's just, it really comes down to assessments. Anybody on nights? All right? It also comes down to waking your patient up throughout the night and assessing them. They may not like that initially, but if you just opposite it up front with, you know, because you're here with what we're trying to rule out as a stroke, we may have to wake you up more often to make sure that everything's okay. You know, even if I liken it sometimes to people, people do understand that if there's a head injury, you have to wake them up throughout the night, right? You know, because I think that's a pretty lay kind of a topic. Use that sometimes. You know, I have to wake you up or do your assessment. So I'm going to start out this morning with just a little bit of this neuroanatomy. What symptoms are you going to see if this is the part of the brain that gets affected? Then I'm going to talk a little bit on ischemic strokes because you're not going to be working with an MR agent. It's just an ischemic. So we'll get into that. And then Sarah Miller, who's one of our stroke clinicians, is going to come and do the NIH stroke assessment with Delegate. Because everybody NIH certified, right? But was it easy or was it hard to get through that?
It was terrible.
It was terrible, I know. Especially, huh? Yeah, some of it's hard. The NIH is, again, looks at subtleness. And it wouldn't be hard if you could just say, yes, it's there, or no, it's not. They make it grade the severity of it. And I think that's when you're trying to put a number on it that it gets more difficult. But Sarah will go over it with you again. So if you have any questions on the NIH, ask her. She'll also go over all the core measures that have to be completed and why. And then she'll talk a little bit about the code grader or Stephanie. All right, so that's kind of how the day will go. So let me get started. So with the brain, what is the brain? Very intricate. There's so many different areas of the brain that does so many different things. And I think that's what's so much fun about the brain. And that's why I love neuro. But what I wanted to show you here, again, don't get wrapped up. Don't try to memorize any of this. This just kind of gives you a little background. There's what are called Brodmann areas that we've identified. You can see they're just numbers placed in different areas of the brain. Well, Dr. Brodmann was a physician back in the 1800s, a while back, and how he labeled the brain, these were his labels, he did it based on autopsy. So he would autopsy, he would look at the here's the amazing thing. We can now take a person and put them into an MRI and do what's called a functional MRI. Have y'all heard of that before? That is where you actually put them in the MRI. You've got a contrast that will light up where the brain activity is. And so you'll ask them to do things like name an object, right? So you show them an object and they name it. And what lights up is your occipital area because you have to see it, and then your ability to recognize it. So it actually lights up the area of the brain that you're using when you're doing it. So they get also auditory naming. You know, they will say things to you. You have to listen to what somebody's saying. What areas of the brain are you using? Visual naming. So we basically can say, count to 10, read something, comprehend something, and we can actually map it out. And the amazing thing is when you do these functional MRIs and you map it out, it maps out to the broadband's territory, all right? Almost to the T. It's really very cool. So you see this little area here, number 3? That is called our motor strip, all right? And the motor strip runs right along here, like where a woman would have put a headband on. So in this area, if I want to move my leg or move my arm or smile, right, that's that facial group, that's all controlled right there by that motor strip, all right? And so you'll see it light up on that functional MRI, and it totally matches the broadband. So it's just, again, a little bit of history, just because it's really pretty cool to think that somebody did that just on quickness. Didn't know what it meant. Had no idea that this little area here was a motor strip, but just knew that it was different and it changed, all right? So that's kind of the broad lens. And like I said, it's nothing to memorize. Don't worry about it. It's just a little bit of background, a little bit of history. So we're going to talk about the different lobes of the brain a little bit. When I talk about deeper structures or subcortical areas, all that means is here's your outer lobes, frontal, parietal, temporal, occipital. And then if you point up kind of towards the roof of your mouth, you're pointing up towards this subcortical area, which is kind of those deeper structures. And that's like your basal ganglia, your thalamus, your subthalamic areas. So that's what we call subcortical. All right, and we can have a stroke anywhere in the brain, okay? And then we're going to talk a little bit about brainstem and cerebellum. So we're going to talk about all the different areas within the brain that can actually have a stroke, okay? So, the first thing I go into a little bit on is the two different hemispheres, all right? So you have the right hemisphere and you have the left hemisphere. How many of y'all heard of things like, are you a left brain thinker or are you a right brain thinker? Have y'all heard some of that? There's lots of books out there on that. You know, how you predominantly think, if you think more on your right or you think more on your left. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a little bit of a research study here. And I'll tell you, I already know how it's going to end, but we're going to do a little research. So as I go through what the left side of the brain does and then what the right side of the brain does, as I'm doing this, think about where you predominantly think from, right? And then we'll look at both at the end. And you can't say both. All right? you have to make a decision. All right, so let's start with this left brain thinker. So the left hemisphere is primarily our math, our science, our logical thinking. It's our analytical reasoning. It's our deductive reasoning. So again, it's kind of that very meticulous, higher level of thinking. You know, like I said, with the analytical, logical thinking, it's your rationale, your ability to plan things, right? That's your left brain, math. Now, your right brain is more of your imagination, your inductive reasoning. It's more of your intuition. It's kind of your emotional center. It's really good at recognizing tones, like if somebody is being facetious or not being real. It's your ability to say, hey, guys, they're joking. They're playing around, all right, when they're saying something seriously. So it's your art, your spiritual, your music is on your right hemisphere. So that being said, how many of you in here are left-brain thinkers? Look around the room always a 50-50. How many of y'all wanted to raise your hand for both? Did you think on both sides of your brain? Yeah, you know what? Here's my theory. I think that's why we're nurses. I really do. Why did you not go become a doctor? Have you ever been asked that? Why did you become a nurse? Why did you not become a doctor? Where do you think doctors probably predominantly come from? Left. Yeah. I'm not going to say all, but predominantly, I'd say most of your positions are left. So I think that some of us probably did go into nursing because we do have both sides pretty well developed. I think some of the other ones, we go in for one side or the other, and we kind of develop both because we need both to be a nurse, which is a little bit different. What do y'all think? Pretty cool? Yeah, I think so. Like I said, I've done it a lot, and it's how it turns out. So what does that mean to a stroke patient? What does it mean to somebody who's either having a stroke or has a history of a stroke? What does it mean by what if they lose? All right, and how do we recognize it? So if their stroke was on the left side of their brain, think about the things they lost. They lost their ability to do analytical reasoning, mathematics. I always say, think about rehab on somebody with a left brain ischemic or infarct, is they have to relearn how to shop, right? They don't even know anything about money. So they have to, in rehab, go to grocery stores, show them how to look at prices, because that's what they've lost, is that ability. They've lost some of their rational thinking. They say things really off the wall. Yeah, you look at them like, really, you just said that? Yeah, or what's that about? Because they've lost that ability. It is your control center for your emotions. So my emotions are in my right hemisphere. My inhibition, my control of that is in my left hemisphere. What if I lose that? What do people with strokes do? They do things, they say things, they don't care, right? They don't have that social inhibition, right? My dad's had a small stroke, and I promise you, we'll be out in a grocery store, and he'll walk up to a complete stranger, and he'll say, that doesn't match. I'm like, all right, out, Dad. You know, a friend of mine whose family had Alzheimer's, she had a little business card made up so that when her mom started being obnoxious to people, she would just kind of slide the waiter the business card, and the business card says, I have Alzheimer's, please be nice to me, or something like that. Yeah, I feel like I'll do that with my dad, sorry. He's a stroke. He's not thinking right. Because they do, they totally lose inhibition. And they'll say things and do things and come dressed inappropriately. And the other thing is really bad is your frontal lobe has your micturition center. So then if you have that stroke in the left frontal lobe, they just pee. They don't, if you've had stroke patients, a lot of times they're incontinent. Not that they couldn't do, but they just are disinhibited to it. We've seen them in rehab just go and go to the corner and start peeing, you know? It's like, okay. So again, they lose that social. They also are more prone to aphasia. We'll talk more about aphasia. Sorry, your expressives and receptives. And they develop what's called apraxia. And we'll talk more about those as we go along. The right brain, one of the things they do is they start to neglect the left side. All right? So if you have a right brain stroke, what they mean by neglect